Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today by Texas Politics Project Research Director, Mr. Dr. Joshua Blank.
Mr. Doctor, that's me. Mr. Doctor Professor.
Monsieur Doctor, I don't know how to say that.
Or most frequently,
Monsieur Medic.
Most frequently, Professor Blake.
Professor Blake, right.
The usual.
Yes, yes.
AKA Professor Blake.
Yes, the Blake Henderson course. So, end of the semester here at the Second Reading Podcast, you'll have to tolerate a few end of the semester student gripes.
Not a gripe, it's an observation.
We'll try. Yeah, it was a good natured gripe, Dr. Blake.
I responded to that kid and I misspelled his first name just for fun.
Nothing like teaching the kids a little passive aggressiveness.
Just for fun.
Also on the menu today. Last week we focused on what were the top matter from the April 2026 Texas Politics Project poll. Today I thought we'd look at some of the less headline-grabbing results, although only barely, actually. But still, I think we talked about this last week, there were a lot of atmospherics in this poll as opposed to a lot of, whoa, look at that. I mean, I was doing a radio spot with our friends at KURV yesterday afternoon. And at the end, they didn't really ask me any surprise question, maybe a little bit, but they did. They asked me the surprise question. I was kind of, well, nothing really super surprising. I think I went with a little bit of the disjointness on some of the macro and personal economy numbers we haven't really talked about, which stuck out a little bit. But then they asked, as part of that answer, I was talking about how negative everything was, kind of paused and said, well, so is there anything to be hopeful about? And when I went through all the negative stuff, they were laughing. I could hear them laughing on the other end. And then they said, well, is there anything hopeful? And I just kind of said, well, now it's my turn to laugh. But anyway, so
summer break.
Became a pretty grim yuck fest for drive time radio, but be that as it may.
Well, it reinforces a point you made actually when we released the poll, and something I think you and I have both seen both from the release into sort of this week is, I mean, the variety of sort of press calls that I think we're both fielding is pretty remarkable. I mean, usually there's something that happens and then it kind of focuses and usually have like a couple things around, central tendencies. But over the last couple of weeks, it's really been kind of all over the place. But to your point, uniformly negative. I mean, it's sort of from one thing to the next. It's kind of like, it's like, hey, is the state running out of water? Like, hey, there's a war in Iran. Hey, let's talk about Camp Mystic. And it's like, whew, okay. It's been a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot going on out there. And the poll, I think, did reflect that, which it should.
Yeah.
So I thought today we'd do something, at least start with something a little, orthogonal to all that maybe in some ways. Right. And that is just, I guess it depends on where you sit. But looking at what we got in some of the state races here in for Texas government, some of the generics, which were telling in their own way, if not dramatically so. And then maybe check in some of the other, one of the other major environmental factors in play and shaping the electoral environment now and as we head towards the election over the next 5+ months. And that's how Texas voters are thinking about Donald Trump and his policy performance. Which, as it turns out, are not just conceptually distinct, but as we'll unpack, a bit different from each other, and we kick that around. Let's start thinking a little locally before we get more global and look at the trial head-to-heads in the April polling data. And, we should point out is, people, of course, I think pointed on Twitter or something. I mean, these were somewhere between hypothetical and trial ballots, right? Because they are not what's going to be on the ballot. We didn't have third party candidates on here. But we did pull some of the top, you know, the two top races where Republicans and Democrats have settled on their candidates, governor and lieutenant governor. So let's start with the governor. What do we got?
Yeah. And I think, you know, even to your point, you know, this is something of a heat check, you know, given the fact that the real, you know, to some degree, attention grabbing result in the poll was the fact that, you know, Tallarico was leading both Paxton and Cornyn, which we unpacked, you know, pretty in depth last week as to the, sort of the whys behind that. And in general, sort of the lack of Republican unity at this point in the race. But the difference is we don't see that on these other races. And so we see different results.
And we mentioned it in passing last week, but I thought maybe we just unpack it.
It's really important. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I, you know, overall, and we'll get into this as we sort of step out from it, but it's something that's really important as so much attention and energy is geared towards the Senate race. People sort of, you know, might forget the fact that, you know, Greg Abbott's running for re-election himself to, you know, a record-setting term. Dan Patrick running for another term to office. There are a bunch of, you know, very well-resourced, very successful statewide officials who are also going to be on the ballot in addition to this other race. And when we look at those races, there's a lot less reticence, you know, if any. Abbott leads State Representative Gina Hinojosa 44-38 in this sort of hypothetical two-way matchup. 5% say they choose someone else. 13% say they haven't formed an opinion yet about that race. So in total, that's 18% who said, you know, not sure yet, don't know, someone else. That compares to about 24-26% on the Senate ballots. And as we go down, you know, sort of down ballot, we see that number go up again. Importantly, right, as we kind of pointed out with the Senate race, whereas 80% of Democrats were supporting Tallarico, we only saw about 60% support at this moment in time for each of the potential Republican nominees. But we don't see that same pattern here at the top of the ticket. So what we see is 81% of Democrats say they'll be supporting Hinojosa. 78% of Republicans say that they will be supporting Abbott. We'd say that's statistically indistinguishable from each other. And so, you know, the big sort of notable thing to kind of, I would say that sort of stands out a little bit in this is that, you know, Abbott's slightly underwater with independents, 24-30, but there's 46% who haven't made up their minds yet, which is a huge share of independents in that race. And so, you know, assuming Hinojosa is not going to pull in all of those voters, and even if she did, that would still actually only narrow his lead a little bit in what we see here.
Right. I mean, you know, back of the envelope math, that's, you know, what, about a third, well, if you do the someone else, 46, you know, little less than half of 11%,
10%, let's
just say. I think it was 10% was the true independent on that.
Yeah.
And then what about the lieutenant governor's race?
Yeah, and so in the lieutenant governor's race, now once again, you know, anything as we move down the ballot, we see less attention, less knowledge. That's true when we look at everything about the lieutenant governor's office. When we look at job approval numbers, you know, he's not in the same stratosphere as, let's say, Abbott and Trump, for example. But that's not because there's negativity. It's just less overall.
Yeah, that's a consistent feature of polling. I mean, sometimes he gets up a little, you know, we can just say he, because it's been lieutenant governor, it's been Patrick for so long, but sometimes during the session, for obvious kinds of reasons, he gets a little closer to parity. The problem is the governor also goes up during session too a little bit in terms of name recognition and I wouldn't call it name recognition, just top of mindedness among voters.
Right. So the first thing to note here is whereas about 18% of voters said someone else or hadn't thought about enough to an opinion in the governor's race and lieutenant governor's race, that goes up to 34%. So it almost doubles. I mean, not exact, a little bit less than doubles. And in this race, you know, Patrick has a 4-point lead as opposed to Abbott's 6-point lead. So Patrick's at 35, Goodwin is at 31. Again, pretty parallel numbers with the partisans. 62% of Democrats say they're going to support Goodwin. Again, that's a reflection of name ID, which we can talk about in a second. 64% of Republicans say they are going to support Patrick. And again, the split among independents goes Goodwin's way slightly, 13 for Patrick, 21 for Goodwin. And I think this is just also important to note at this point, independents are generally dissatisfied with political leadership always, and Republicans are in charge, so there is more just kind of obvious reasons for them to choose someone else, regardless.
Well, something I think that we haven't quite, I mean, we keep, you know, we keep threatening to just do a pod on independence, which eventually we'll get around to. But I think that, you know, the other interesting thing that I think is buttressing that tendency for independents to be, you know, crabby about incumbents is that, you know, there is an alignment right now between Republican government at the national level and at the state level. And that's reinforcing this tendency in Texas.
Let's put a pin in that point because we'll come back to that when we talk about Trump's impact on the national environment. Because ultimately, you know, his attitudes among independents towards Trump are very negative.
Yeah, it's a good, yeah, I mean, it was a good setup.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I just want to say before we move away from this is just, you know, again, if the headline news here in some ways was, you know, that Tallarico was up in these, you know, hypothetical trial bouts, you know, this is an important piece of context here, which is that Abbott is still leading this race. Patrick is still leading his race. And a big part of this is the challenge that faces all Democrats, which is that when we look at attitudes towards their, like, you know, in Abbott's case, his opponent, and in Patrick's case, his likely opponent, we find that 53% of voters have no opinion of Gina Hinojosa at this point. 71% have no opinion of Vicky Goodwin at this point. And so that's the challenge that all Democrats have.
And we're picking up party ID here.
Yeah. And so so to the extent the numbers are where they are, some of that's party. But it's also the case that, you know, whereas Abbott and Patrick are known quantities with, you know, very, you know, resource rich, the Democrats in this race face the challenge that all Democrats face, which is that they're going to have to introduce themselves to the electorate at a pretty significant disadvantage.
Right, right. With, you know, you sort of mentioned the resources, and I would say both, you know, financial and institutional.
Right.
Right. As we see, you know, Governor Abbott has been making headlines in the political press anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In the last couple of months, which is kind of what this, you know, last month anyway, you know, which makes sense and is something that we should expect. The Democratic candidates have no opportunity to do that.
Right.
They can issue press releases. They can, you know, use social media. They can try to do appearances and get some earned media on that. But it's a real uphill battle. I mean, I think the other thing I would say about this is just stepping back to kind of elaborate the point you're making just a little bit, which is, you know, these races, I think, are good kind of benchmarking assessments for where we are right now.
Right.
You know, and I think we talked about this a little bit in the poll rollout. You know, this idea of, okay, what is the baseline Republican advantage? You know, our sample had a
plus 10,
10, you know, 10 point, you know, Republican share was 10 points higher than the Democrats in the sample, with the other 10 being independents. You know, you talk to people in the business, there are different estimates out there about what this kind of default Republican advantage should be. Mm-hmm. You still hear 10, which, if you accept that, which is what we got in the sample once we weighted it by demographics, not including party. And then you have Greg Abbott, which is the benchmark below this, you know, given all the things we've said about the Senate race.
Right.
Up by 6 with about 1 in 5 vote, a little less than 1 in 5 voters not having formed an opinion or paying attention. It all feels about right.
Well, I mean,
and
I think, you know, to reinforce that, we've got the generic trial ballots. And when we look at the generic text ledge trial ballot, so who, you know, are you going to vote for the generic Republican or Democratic candidate for state legislature? The Republicans have 4-point advantage, 44, which is exactly where Abbott is, 40 for the Democrat. And on the congressional side, and again, Congress right now, you know, pretty negative attitudes across the board. So there's a little bit more noise in this, but pretty similar. Republicans are up to 43-41. So again, pretty much similar area. I mean, what you'll notice is that the specific Democrat who Democrats don't know about is trailing the generic Democrat. Abbott is essentially the benchmark relative to the generic Republican here. And then to your overall point, I think what's interesting is that, you know, I mean, there's sort of two points that I kind of take from this. One is to say, you know, this is sort of, again, it calibrates our understanding even further of the Senate results and sort of thinking about that race, number one. So on the one hand, you know, you don't want to be embracing too much this notion, well, Texas is competitive if Tallarico is up on these guys for all the reasons we've already talked about. And also this reinforces, like, hey, you know, Republicans are still in the advantageous position. But to your point, you know, what we talk about every cycle is, well, what is the Republican advantage? You know, what does it look like, right? What do we think on a good day, you know, the Republican vote margin is going to look like in Texas? And, you know, I mean, to your point, I mean, you know, sort of follow up to your point, you know, with a reaction, it's like when you look at it and you say, yeah, plus 6 Abbott, plus 4 Patrick, you know, plus 2 to plus 4 on the trial ballots, you know, that sounds about right. But it's also like, that is a lot narrower than it used to be. I mean, you know, and just going back in the polling that we've looked at over time, is, and we've brought this up before, even though this is, you know, good news for Republicans and that we're, you know, in some ways telling them what they already know, which is that they still maintain a party ID advantage in the state. They probably maintain an advantage in the actual electorate. But man, if it's not contracting.
Well, I think what's interesting is here, after spending years after 2018 saying not to over-rely on 2018.
Yeah.
it frankly looks a little like 2018.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
You know, where you've got a potentially tight Senate race,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got some yellow flags in the statewides,
mm-hmm.
you know, in which you're, you know, you're not likely to see, you know, Abbott, you know, you're not likely to see 14 and 20 point wins necessarily,
right.
which we had seen during some of the high points of Republican mm-hmm. hegemony in these midterm elections. With the usual caveat, and there's also the piece here that I think, you know, I think we went back and looked at this, and I think this holds up pretty well, that when we're looking at these April and June polls of registered voters, mm-hmm. historically, Democrats have run a little stronger,
yeah.
and Republicans wind up outperforming those mm-hmm. numbers, but not in some of these big Democratic surge years.
Yeah. Yeah. And that right. makes sense because if you think about it, whereas, you know, we've sort of talked about this, you know, the Republicans who are running for statewide office have likely been in government for a while and have, you know, taken positions, right? They've had to do things that have, you know, put them at odds with even some of their voters at times, even if only a minority. And that creates these, you know, opportunities for primary challengers, a little bit of hurt feelings. Whereas for Democrats, it's all, I mean, a lot of it's like, who's up? And then yeah. it's like, well, this is the person this year. And so there's not really any question in some ways that a lot of the Democrats don't have a lot of pressures. It's just who is the candidate usually. And that's kind of what you see here. To your point, why they generally run a little bit better earlier in the year. I will say, you know, one to your point about the 2018, I mean, what it makes me wonder is, you know, 2018 wasn't 2018 until it was 2018, right? And there's sort of like a, you know, how much of this did we know when we knew it versus how much of it became apparent over time? And to some extent, it's like, I agree with you. It does feel like 2018 in a way. And when we look at kind of the macro environment, but what I wonder is, you know, are the Democrats starting in a stronger place now relative to where they were starting that race in 2018? That's something that I think we can look at the data and kind of think a little bit about. And it's not a simple answer. I think, you know, in some sort of generic sense, you might think so. In another sense, knowing what we know about the party favorability items and sort of the general dissatisfaction with the Democratic Party, especially the end of kind of the Biden term, exactly where things stand, right? But I mean, I think that's sort of an open question here to my mind is, does this look like we're on that same trajectory or are we somewhere else? But, you know, the current,
I'm kind of putting in my notes of things to check.
Right? Yeah.
Like what's the same and what's different from 2018 is not a bad
way to think about that.
Not a bad thematic, right? In terms of, you know, to your point, one of those things being, and I don't remember what the trend data look like.
Mm-hmm.
What is the state of the Democratic brand?
Right.
Right. And my gut feeling is, and I don't know if this will hold up in the numbers, but I think it does based on my faulty memory, is that, you know, Democratic favorability ratings are down. Now, I don't know how much they're down relative to Republican favorability ratings.
And with whom is another key part
of
this.
Yeah, right. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, in particular in things we've been thinking about this week and another front, I'm as much interested in that of where's the brand among Democrats as I am among anything else.
Exactly.
So let's move on to some of the bigger than atmospherics that we didn't talk about last time and environmental factors. And I think we touched on this a little in relation to immigration, border security versus economy prices last week, but mm-hmm. just a little. But I want to focus, but I think we focused on the most important problem facing the country last time.
Yeah.
So I thought we'd want to take a closer look at what we got from most important from the item asking people to tell us what the most important problem facing Texas is.
Right. So, you know, here the story has still been about this steady decline in the focus on immigration and the border. And so not surprisingly, when we sort of said, you know, what's the most important issue facing Texas, you know, economic concerns were, you know, top of the list. If we look at sort of broken down, inflation and prices were the top, were the top one at 15%. In third place was the economy at 9%. And a little further down was unemployment and jobs at 3%, which if, you know, you add all that up, that makes 25%. That's one in four voters, right? You know, by contrast, immigration and border security, which have historically been top issues, were 8% and 4% respectively. Now, this is almost always the share of Texans who say that immigration and border is the most important problem facing the state is almost always driven by Republican voters. I mean, overwhelmingly. And what's interesting in this poll is that the share of Republican voters who said immigration or border security dropped to 20%, which is the lowest it's been probably, you know, since COVID, maybe before. We have a really good graphic on the site that actually tracks this. But importantly, when you combine the share of Republicans who say inflation and prices 12%, the economy 10%, or unemployment and jobs, that's 25%. That's one in four Republicans. And it's more than are saying immigration and border security right now. That's the, I mean, if you say like what stands out to you as someone, you know, if we're watching public, you know, we're watching public opinion all the time. We know people, this is something underlying all of this. It really, to me, is driving a lot of the politics in the state right now, is sort of the way that immigration has fallen off the radar as the primary focus right. for a lot of Republican voters. Doesn't mean it's not important. Doesn't mean it's not still important. But I mean, I was talking to you about this on the way coming in. I mean, to the extent that, you know, Abbott is now using powers within the executive branch to put pressure on Texas cities over their lack of fealty to like immigration enforcement, that's a way to turn this issue on when right. it's kind of hard to do it right now.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the interesting thing about that, that I think we talked about a little bit in regard to the last poll because we had the items there, but in February when we included our broader immigration questions about legal immigration, but particularly the heat check question we periodically talk about on the podcast, it'll be familiar to regular listeners. That is the, do you agree or disagree with the statement that everybody, anybody in the state, who, anybody in the country who's here without documentation should be deported illegally.
Immediately.
Or should be deported immediately, gotcha. Yeah. That number is actually at an all-time high right now right. among Republicans.
Right.
In other words, it was typically in the mid to high 80s, and it's been, I think, consistently breaking 90.
Yeah, it's really in the high 80s from the low 80s.
For three or four polls now.
Right.
Right. And so the trick here, if you're, you know, to talk about the Abbott actions vis-a-vis the cities on immigration and the border or immigration enforcement, is to tap into that.
Yeah.
Right. Even if it's not entirely salient, given what we see in the MIP or there's more competing with it, you can still be pretty sure that this is going to resonate positively with a big chunk of Republican voters, even if it's not as top of mind or there are things competing with those dispositions as it's being received.
Well, and a reminder, you know, what was also in that poll was that there is this sort of idea about, you know, this immediate deportation of anyone who's here undocumented, and it's very high. And then we ask about specific circumstances, right? And we find right. that, you know, support for these deportation activities drops off as you get a little bit more specific, and depending on where you're talking about, hospitals, churches, right. schools. But what's, you know, politically astute about this approach is you're talking about police interactions. We're not talking about, you know, going into the schools. He's not talking about, you know, having people hanging out outside of
like
social services.
It's a little more concrete, but not too much.
No, but it's a little bit more concrete, but it's a little bit more concrete along the lines of what you're
talking about. In the right
direction. In the right direction, right towards, yeah, towards criminal enforcement of, you know, basically people interacting with police. And that's sort of, again, I think that feels very comfortable within the attitude space that we've been talking about. But it also, again, it allows, I mean, there's something about that this is just so familiar, which is you've got Republican control of state government. You've got Republican complete control of the federal government. You can't really talk about immigration, but it's an issue that traditionally binds your electorate. So who do we talk about? The Democratic cities and their lack of immigration enforcement. It's not, you know, outside of the bounds of the normal playbook.
Right. Well, because it taps into the immigration and enforcement sentiments and also taps into partisanship.
Yeah, exactly. Basically.
Pardon me, in a very direct way.
Right.
You know, before we move on for those, I also want to flag a little bit a couple of the subgroups. So for a long time, independents on – when we looked at independents in these MIP ratings, they fell sort of between Democrats and Republicans, but probably looked a little more like Republicans in terms of the salience of immigration and border security. That's also changed as part of this dynamic we were talking about a minute ago. So only 8% of independents said either immigration or border security. The economic numbers there add up to even
39.
Higher than the quarter.
Up to 39, know. Yeah.
Right. So another way in which independents are positioning themselves, you know, are positioned as of now in a way that doesn't look great for Republicans if you're looking in the general election for discourses that will shore up your standing and give you a little bit of a cushion in the context of a little less certainty about what the Republican margin is going to be.
Right.
Right. And in terms of the you know, something we say in here all the time, that elections are in part, you know, contests for agenda control.
That's right.
Now, the other piece here at a more general level is that the direction numbers on the state and the country are pretty wretched.
To put it mildly. Yeah, no, it's well done.
I mean, particularly at the national level. They're a little less so at the state level, but they're not great.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, there'd been a few polls in December and into February where it seemed like things were rebounding a bit. You know, back last year, you know, if we, you know, go back to, let's say, just June of last year, you know, it was 37 thought the country was going on the right track, 54 wrong track. Let's just stick with wrong track. In August, it went up to 59. In October of 25, up to 58. And then at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, it started to drop a little bit, 53% in each of the last two polls. Now, again, damning with faint praise, still a majority saying the country's on the wrong track. Jump to April, only 34% of Texans, basically just a scratch over a third, say we're headed in the right direction. 59% say we're on the wrong track. Now, oftentimes, you know, the state is a little bit more durable, you know, in some ways to some of these, you know, sort of moments of friction, which I think, you know, the war is really, I think, obviously exacerbated here, if I'm just going to guess. But what we found in the April poll for the state was that 42% said the state was headed in the right direction. That's unchanged from February. 47% think the state is on the wrong track. That's up 2 points from February. And ultimately, you know, just marks another poll in which Texans mark the state is headed in the wrong direction, or more think the state's headed
on
the wrong track.
At least a plurality. I mean, that, you know, I think we broke 51 maybe back in October.
Back in October, we were above 50%, but then we hadn't been
on
above
the wrong track.
Yeah, but we hadn't been up above 50% before that since 2023.
Yeah.
And before that, since 2021. So it's not, I mean, like once a year it might pop up here. And, but generally speaking, but even before that, if we go back into, you know, a deeper history, the poll goes back a long ways. There's a long stretch in which we didn't see the plurality of Texans on the wrong side of that.
Yeah.
Number.
And the numbers weren't underwater.
No. And oftentimes we would see, you know, even close to a majority saying right direction. And it's not, it's just, right. It's long gone, is just to say. I mean, I think how much of that is just the partisan politics and polarization and everything else, and how much of that is actually just overall performance based. Is a little bit tough to say, but I mean, I will say this, there's a little bit of kind of a similar pattern here to what we're seeing in some of this other stuff, which is, you know, Democrats are very clear. 80% think the state's on the wrong track. You know, 58% of independents think the state is on the wrong track right now. But on the flip side, 69% of Republicans think the state is headed in the right direction, with nearly one in five, 19% saying we're on the wrong track. Now, what the constellation, the nature of that one in five is, I think.
And there's not an intensity meter, you know, measure.
No,
there,
and look, we, you know, we study this, and you guys listen to this, and we know that among the one in five Republicans who are unhappy with the direction of state, some share of them are saying, hey, yeah, because we're not conservative enough, or we haven't gone and done everything we could do, and some are on that other side. So it's a mix within that.
Yeah.
And also, I think this goes back to the other point that we've already made a couple times in this podcast, which is governing is hard. You know, ultimately, there are, you know, trade-offs to be made, agendas to be selected, and not every Republican is going to be happy with Republican leadership, whereas Democrats can be uniformly unhappy.
Yeah, I'm not trying to, and I don't want to try to paint
no.
the Republican attitudes. I mean, to your kind of qualification there, I don't want to over-paint Republicans as overly negative. But as we're working on this other piece that's follow-up from last week in terms of gauging, you know, Republican enthusiasm, potential, you know, opportunities, but more critically at this point, drags on Republican turnout, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's worth noting that 30, you know, if you put the don't knows in that direction, and I think if your party is in control,
yeah,
and somebody asks you if your state is headed in the right direction and you say you don't know, that's not a good response.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's as bad as somebody going, it's on the wrong track, but it's problematic, I think. And again, at least a yellow flag. And I'm kind of struck by, I would have to dig into this more than I have to think about, but that 19 number, that just around one in five share of Republicans that are unsettled in some way. I mean, that proximate to that number recurs a lot in the Republican internals.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of what you see in some of the Paxton Cornyn numbers when you look at the share of people that don't, you know, that don't have a positive view of one or the other.
Yeah.
Right. There's this, that seems to be kind of the level of dissent, discomfort, reservation, however you want to paint it, among Republicans in a lot of these assessments.
Well, you know, there's something that I've been looking at. I'm just now we're in rank speculation territory for a second. I mean, there's something that stands out to me when I look at the direction numbers, and it makes me think about a lot of something, some other stuff that I've been looking at. But this is a small difference, but it makes me think about this, which is when you look at that right direction, wrong track, you know, Republican women are 66 right direction, 21 wrong track, 14 don't know. Republican men would say 71 right direction, 18 wrong track, 11 don't know. And I think I wouldn't be surprised based on some other data that I've looked at that, you know, if you look at Republican women a little bit more closely, there might be some differentiations in there. And in particular, something that I just happen to have been looking at, you know, over the last number of polls, and it's not something that like it's just sort of in my notes, you know, kind of thing, is to look at attitudes towards Trump among married Republican women and unmarried Republican women. And whereas there's really no gap, if you look across the job approval numbers, where there's no gap between married and unmarried Republican men, there's about at least a 10-point gap in almost every single job approval area between married Republican women and unmarried Republican women. And so one of the things that, you know, we've been for years, you know, in some sense, you know, the, you know, political analysts have been saying, okay, you know, Trump is so it's such a shock to the system. Clearly, there's going to be an effect at some point, or he's so, you know, he's doing something that's antithetical to Republican orthodoxy. Surely at this point, someone's going to drop out. And if you've been following the data, the answer is like, well, not really. You know, we don't really see that very much, certainly not in any sort of massive way. And the first thing to acknowledge is it's not going to be in a massive way. We're talking about margins.
Right.
Number one. And then number two, because we're talking about margins, you know, we need a certain amount of sample size. We need a certain amount of time to like really uncover what the nature of the attrition looks like. But to your point, the more that I look at this, the more, you know, I think that, you know, the attrition is probably somewhere in Republican women. Historically, we do see a gender gap, but it's almost always explained by party. You can almost always say, no, when you look at it, it's actually the fact that this is just, they're more Democratic identifying women than men. And so therefore, you know, you're just seeing that in part. When you start to see it between the Republican women and the Republican men, and you start to see even within that Republican women themselves, that's sort of an interesting question.
Yeah, it seems like there's something going on there.
Seems like there's something going on there.
Right. I guess the other thing I would want to just flag as we're looking at that recurring topic is the Hispanic numbers.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, in the country, Hispanics are 35 right direction, 58 wrong track, which is, I think, pretty interesting. You know, pretty much identical to the overall numbers. And then on the state, similar situation, but higher negatives, 41 right direction, 52 wrong track.
Right.
Which in our ongoing discussion of where Hispanics are and, you know, where they're settling, it's nice to look at this in a way separate from party ID for just a second, but to also notice that these are pretty close to our party ID numbers. And as we'll see, by way of transition, pretty close to the Trump approval numbers.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, as Hispanics become, you know, the plurality population in the state and increasingly, you know, a larger and larger share, it is interesting the extent to which, you know, their views are looking more and more like the central tendency of the state, which is interesting. But the other thing to sort of notice in this that I would say, and, you know, you can, you know, whatever, agree, disagree, move on, but like, you know, the bottom has not fallen out for Trump or Republicans among Hispanics in terms of the gains that he made, right? I mean, not to say that we're not where we are in October of, you know, 2024, right? We're not sitting there looking at, you know, in, you know, even numbers amongst that group after everything that's happened. But it's also not the case that, like, Republicans in Texas don't seem to be, like, hemorrhaging Hispanic support. And if anything, the floor has remained pretty solid, even with increasing concerns about the economy, even with, you know, again, an overall issue environment that probably is not helpful with that group. It's still the case that, you know, you've got 35% to 41% of, you know, Hispanics who are pretty much, you know, on the Republican side of the ledger on any issue.
Which, again, is as the point we've made in here repeatedly, not to beat this horse bloody, but, you know, not too far off what we've seen historically.
Yeah.
I mean, we're, you know, I mean, it's going to turn out, I think, probably in the time series when we get a few more post-Trump election observations, that was a high tide within an identifiable band.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it'll probably be a peak for a while, I suspect.
Yeah.
Subject to, you know, something we've said in here already without getting all overly into it again, but the one of the things that I think we've discovered over the last two decades of focusing on Hispanics and trying to figure out what their partisanship is that, you know, they fluctuate, they move.
Yeah, that's right. I do think the floor has, I mean, you know, we keep talking about the ceiling, but the floor is raised. I think that's the key thing.
But I guess my point would be probably not by a ton. I mean, it was what you were saying.
I think we can marry these two points and kind of move on to the next one. But I mean, if you marry them together, the point I think to make here is that, you know, any simple characterization of the electoral environment in a state as dynamic as Texas is kind of just stupid on its face.
Right.
Because I think what we're seeing is, Trump is doing a lot of things and pushing the party in a direction that makes certain members of the party very, very happy, but is making a small share a little uncomfortable. Is it so uncomfortable that they're like going to vote for a Democrat? Probably not in most cases. Is it so uncomfortable that they might not turn out in an election?
Right.
Maybe. And in close elections, that really matters. But, you know, I think what this is a pre-plea to not jump on the simplest answer to some of this stuff, because I think it's actually going to be a combination of a lot of different trends going on right now is going to be the sum total of kind of what is going on in this election cycle. Most likely it has to do with age, has to do with education, it has to do with gender, it has to do with race and ethnicity, and, you know, probably some other factors potentially. But like, and that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know. Okay.
All right. So let's look at Trump.
Right.
To close this out. So I think the dilemma here that's becoming more clear, particularly in the state, I think we're seeing this elsewhere. I mean, you know, there were headlines about in the last few days about Trump's ability to intervene in state legislative elections reasonably successfully. Mm-hmm. Now, I've read some digging down into this suggest not to overextrapolate here, given who won and who didn't. But still, the trope that is based on something is that Trump is still can still drive electoral behavior at the state level and can have a real effect on state elections, the Indiana elections where they had targeted seven state senators or a handful of state senators that had been opposed to redistricting when they were doing the redistricting tear in the last few months. And I think he got five of the seven
or
something like that. And so that's looming over here. And we've talked a lot about Trump as a vehicle for the nationalization of politics in the state, yada, yada, yada. But the dilemma there, I think, is a real one in an electoral environment. In that Trump remains clearly strong enough among Republicans to both incentivize behavior among candidates and office holders. And he's strong enough to define the Republican national brand, or at least for that brand to be inextricably linked to him, both his image, but also probably less helpfully his actions from day to day. But he's also very unpopular among everyone else.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, even in a state like, what people would call a ruby red state like Texas, overall, he's underwater on his job approval, 45% approved, 50% disapproved. Now, again, we're not going to go over Republican approval because it's overwhelming. In most cases, it's at least 80% or more in most issue areas. But in some key ones, you know, he's got some problems here. So when we think about this, I'm just going to quickly lay out his overall approval in a couple key areas and then his approval in the suburbs, because that's where we see the most political competition in the state, among Hispanics, because that's one of the groups that we see the most political competition over, and among independents, because in a close election, ultimately their votes matter more, you know, in some way at a certain point. So overall, he's underwater, 45 approve, 50 disapprove. In the suburbs, a little bit worse than that, 45 approve, 52 disapprove. Among Hispanics, a little bit worse than that, but not terrible. Just, 41 approve, 55 disapprove. Among independents, only 20 approve and 73% disapprove. Now, this was the highest disapproval rating that we measured for him among independents across two terms in office. And I think that no doubt is a reflection also, again, of the moment in time, the Iran war, the impact on prices. Now, I was sort of saying that the suburb and Hispanic numbers weren't that bad, but they're still majorities disapproving. He's still 7 and 14 points among underwater in the suburbs and among Hispanics. Now, if the economy remains front and center, you know, this is where the real problems come up for Republicans who are trying to be as close to them as they can. On the economy, 36 approve of the job he's doing, 52 disapprove. So a little bit significantly lower approval, 9 points, a little bit higher disapproval, 52. Suburbs, 35, 53. Hispanics, 35, 51. And again, independents, 11 approve, 77 disapprove of his handling of the economy. Nearly 4 in 5.
Right.
That's a lot. On inflation and prices, which is ultimately one of his worst areas, 33% approve, 56% disapprove. Suburbs, 31, 57. Hispanics, 33, 57. Among independents, 9 approve, 80% disapprove, which is his worst overall issue area approval rating among independents. And so this is just, you know, again, we've been talking about this a long time. If the economy remains front and center like it appears to be for an increasing share of voters, and Trump remains the central character of the Republican identity and party and, you know, approach to governing.
Right.
You know, this creates problems. I mean, there's just there's no other way to put it, right?
And I really think that, you know, those price numbers, I think, are really telling where, you know, you're seeing 12, 13 point drops in the approval level and, you know, similar increases, though not as direct in the disapproval. But it's the drop in approval levels, I think, that's really telling. You know, the other thing that sticks out to me about these numbers, kind of a slightly trivial thing, but since we've been talking about independents, is that this is not an area where we go, oh, look at independents. They're not paying attention.
Right.
Right. I mean, when you have independents at 2073,
right,
that's not some independents going, oh, I don't know what that Trump guy's doing.
Right. Right.
They are. I mean, this, and again, if you go back, we've come across it in a couple places in the poll all over. You know, there's a lot of things independents in politics are just not paying attention to. Well, guess what? The economy and prices is not one of those things.
Right. Yeah.
Right. In terms of, you know, what kind of targeted mobilization and or targeted persuasion efforts that we are likely to see as the fall campaign gets closer from these campaigns that on both sides – that are looking for something.
Right.
To, you know, if you're a Democrat, it's to push you over the, you know, over the edge, over the threshold. If it's Republicans, it's to hedge.
Well, and to your point, I mean, look, the path is much clearer for Democrats right now because they can say the word affordability without choking, right? And that's something that's going to speak to a lot of people. And it's a word that, you know, the president has, you know, is going to be in ads, you know, sort of fumbling over this word. Republicans are going to have to figure out a way to handle it. And I mean, you know, not to be like, you know, whatever, flip about it, but it's like talking about Sharia law might not work when people are concerned about paying for gas.
Could be people can't afford to think about those things right now.
Yeah. Hierarchy of needs.
Now, having joked about that, this is, again, since we've strayed into speculation at a couple of points here today, I'm not sure that the specific term affordability is going to survive as a Democratic talking point into the fall election. We'll see.
Yeah.
It'll be it'll be some way to look at that, I suppose. Maybe this is just my own it is clearly my own read of it, but I think there are reasons to think that affordability is a little too benign.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite.
Yeah.
It's not quite right, I think, because it's not quite severe enough to me. But
I guess I wonder if, you know, given the concern that we speculate, given the concerns that we believe that a significant share of voters have about Democrats, and I mean, look, and I'm just gonna say, set aside all notion of the current environment or anything else, right?
Yeah.
But let's just say, you know, to some extent, there are a lot of voters who have a concern about Democratic use of government power. And, you know, the extent to which government, you know, Democrats would be willing to use government power for economic, you know, purposes, you know, in some ways, maybe the benignness of affordability is an advantage in some ways, you know, because it is so sort of this thing that's out there that you kind of feel, you know. So what can we do to adjust that feeling, but not like direct the economy? You know, I don't know.
I'm sitting here thinking I don't have a, you know, look, nobody's hiring for me for message development anyway, but I don't have a better term, but I feel like it's a little bit of a stale bagel at this point.
Yeah, I mean,
affordability, you know, and I don't know exactly, I don't know what it would be, but.
I guess the thing is, you know, I mean, I guess the question is, does that become a term that gets filled with more meaning through the campaign, or is there something that's just better that's out there that captures, you know?
Right. And this would be an evolution in the discussion. I mean, I'm not, you know, you just stop. And again, I want to be clear. It's the right spatial location issue-wise.
Yeah.
And based on everything we're seeing.
Yeah.
It's just the term I just, and maybe it's just because it's been overused already.
Yeah.
You know, in my mind, I'm just, you know, and again, there's a double-edged sword there. On one hand, if you adopt that as a good stand-in for economic issues, then
yeah,
that's great. I almost feel like they started a little early with it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, and I'm not disagreeing with you, I'm just thinking out loud. I mean, I think there's probably some benefit to it in the sense that you're not talking about prices, because prices is like everything, right? You know, it's like cost of eggs, it's gas, it's, you know, whatever, sending your kids to, you know, something. You know, whereas affordability can be attacked in a more institutional, systemic sense, and that's like housing affordability. Yeah.
And look,
right?
I haven't seen I haven't seen it, but I can imagine the message testing that validated this approach.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think the fact that Trump stumbled over it so much,
well, that's a
is almost gives it the power it needs to stay, because it'll be in the ads.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, and it gets you away from soaking the rich, or you know, it doesn't, you know, I
hate
think,
speech.
And maybe that's what I don't like about it. I don't know. But it's not, it waters down the class appeal.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, maybe that's really, that's
right.
Actually.
And that's probably seen as its virtue.
Yeah. I mean, that's
right?
the interesting
It doesn't
point.
Lend itself to, oh, it's the Democrats trying to divide us. And, you know, we're the party of prosperity. And, you know, so it does sidestep all that. And I get that.
Yeah. But there's a question.
But,
as to whether
I'm
that's
not
what
sure if
want.
That's not, you know, the right solution to not the problem of the moment.
Right. I see what you're saying.
You know, right?
Yeah, I think I would agree.
I don't know.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think, you know, if I'm, you know, again, nobody's asking us, but it's also like, you know, you take that and you calibrate the risks inherent in sort of being a little bit more class warfare-ish, you know, if you will. And you calibrate that against an environment in which you say, do we need to be class warfare-ish? You know, is that necessary for Democrats? Or just...
Well, and I'm not saying that they should jettison this for, you know, I mean, this is clearly, I mean, a good compromise term for the different contending forces across the spectrum of the Democratic Party right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think the progressive quote unquote wing of the party can talk about affordability without choking and feel like they're still making some of the points they want among class and equity.
And the moderates know they'll never have to utter like price controls.
Right.
And guaranteed income,
and the moderates,
whatever.
You know, feel like they're speaking to the middle class. And so, I mean, I get why it's settled.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just not sure this horse is going to make it to the finish line, put it that way.
In this environment, it's tough to say, but I mean that in multiple ways. It's tough because of just the overall environment being as unpredictable as it is, but also the environment's like pretty charged. I mean, it may be that an environment as charged as it is going to demand a little bit less of an anodyne sounding solution.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's kind of what I'm getting at. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as we were meeting today, you know, gas has gone up another, I think, 20 cents a gallon average in Texas since we met last week.
Right.
You know, so we're now at, I think, 408 today is the average for a gallon, a regular per AAA. And as of this morning on May 7th, I guess it is. So, so that tells us a little bit about, but I mean, in some ways, musing about
whether this term is right
is a good kind of way to sort of sum up.
But that's a good ending.
The cross currents in the environment right now,
which is,
I think.
You know, like if gas prices are still sitting there at 4.0 whatever in Texas or higher, right, in four months, affordability is going
to
sound like
feels to me like you're leaving money on the table by just saying
you're not even.
You know, that's not very affordable.
Yeah. No, you're right. No, if things keep trending in the trajectory that they are, I think, you know, you imagine the heat will turn up.
I would think.
You'd think.
You know, so. Okay, with that, thanks, Josh. Fun, freewheeling discussion today.
Yeah, good times.
Thanks again to our excellent production team of the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Yes, good. Give us that. It's what we like.
Yeah.
We like, raise the roof. I'm showing my age again. Thank you for listening. We've not mentioned it this time. I should have mentioned this earlier. All the sporting data that you can find, the stuff we talked about today, and much more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. I doubt that many of you are listening, but if you have somebody that is graduating, it's graduation weekend at the University of Texas at Austin and in many places around the state. So congratulations to graduates and their families, friends, and supporting network. Congratulations on making it out at a tough time. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.